MAGA rights that are largely or wholly inconsistent with what we used to think of as conservatism.
This hour, how both parties are shifting in the way they see the role of government.
For Tuesday, November 25th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. NPR is reporting the Department of Defense plans to sever all ties with Scouting America, the Boy Scouts.
It's kind of like they don't care about us more than they care about their perceived message.
Also, the Pentagon is investigating Arizona Senator Mark Kelly after he told members of the military that they can refuse illegal orders.
We'll explain how that would actually work.
And a program in Colorado gives people a chance to get a college credential for only $50.
The status quo, the system as it is, it's not working.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. The White House says negotiators have made, quote, tremendous progress on a Russia-Ukraine peace deal, but there's still more work to do, this despite a Thursday deadline for Ukraine to accept it. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says there are a few delicate but not insurmountable details that need to be sorted out. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll has been meeting with Russian and Ukrainian delegations separately in the United Arab Emirates. President Trump also says he's sending his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, to meet with President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Trump's original 28-point plan calls for Ukraine to cede territory that Russia has annexed but not managed to win in nearly 4 years of war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio negotiated some changes to the plan, and Trump says it has been, quote, fine-tuned. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A highly watched economic report on retail spending shows that retail growth slowed down a bit in September, up 0.2% from August. The report from the Commerce Department was delayed because of the government shutdown. NPR's Elena Saluka has more.
The federal data on retail sales is behind by more than a month, and it's showing consumers cooling off a bit in September as they continued to go out to shop and eat. Compared to September of last year, spending at stores and restaurants grew 4.3%, with people shopping more for clothes and electronics in the tail end of the back-to-school season, and they went out to restaurants and bars. All this lines up with a slew of positive sales reports from major retailers, including Walmart, Amazon, Best Buy, and Dick's Sporting Goods. The industry is now predicting another record holiday season, counting on the fact that people generally are employed and wages are still growing faster than inflation. Alina Selyukh, NPR News, Washington.
Prosecutors in Paris have arrested four more people, this in connection with the jewel heist at the Louvre Museum. NPR's Kristen Wright reports they're being questioned by police.
The two men and two women are in custody. Prosecutors say they're from Paris and range in age from 31 to 40. They're suspected of being involved in the October heist at the Louvre. More than $100 million worth of royal jewels were stolen in broad daylight and still haven't been recovered. The thieves pulled up in a moving truck with a ladder and climbed up to a balcony to break in. They had on reflective vests to look like maintenance workers. The heist took less than 10 minutes. It's raised questions about security at the Louvre, the world's most visited museum. Eight people have been arrested so far. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow added 663 points for a 1.4% gain. The S&P was up 60 points, and the NASDAQ moved forward by 153 points to close. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Hyundai and Kia are recalling more than 300,000 vehicles, this because of a defect that could cause a leak in a fuel tank. As NPR's Kamala Demeski reports, the flaw could lead to a fire, although no fires have been reported as of yet.
The recall affects Kia K5s, as well as certain Hyundai Sonatas from model years that are all 2020 or later. Both car brands are part of the Hyundai Motor Group. A single valve can wear out and allow air to enter the fuel tank. That can deform the tank, which can cause a leak. If vehicles experience that problem, drivers might hear a pop noise and smell gasoline. The fix for the defect is expected in January and, as always, will be provided free to drivers. You can check if your vehicle is covered by an active recall on nhtsa.gov or the government's Safer Car app. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Two turkeys named Gobble and Waddle officially were pardoned today by President Trump in an annual ceremony that was held at the White House.
And I'll move over and I will just say very nicely, Gobble, you're pardoned. Come on, let's say it in front of Gobble. Thank you very much, everybody.
Now, instead of ending up on the dinner plate, the two turkeys will be sent to North Carolina State University, where the National Turkey Federation says they'll spend the rest of their days as ambassadors for the food industry. This year's turkeys are the largest ever to receive a pardon. Both birds weighed more than 50 pounds each. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. There is a winter storm warning in effect until noon tomorrow for most of the area. 2 to 8 inches of snow possible, with winds gusting up to 35 miles per hour.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Democrats and Republicans promised different visions of the role of government. For decades, it seemed clear what each party stood for, but those lines are becoming less and less clear as President Trump continues to rewrite the rules in Washington. So we've asked senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith and congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt to help us make sense of how these parties are shifting. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Juana.
So, I mean, for decades, it seemed incredibly clear what each party believed. It was big government versus small government, intervention versus isolation. But now it just feels like those lines are getting incredibly, incredibly blurrier. What is happening here?
Yeah, I mean, if you saw an R or a D next to someone's name, you could generally guess what that person's political philosophy was. You know, it was a pretty fair proxy. Democrats, government isn't a problem, but a solution. Republicans favor small government, more socially conservative. But that has changed in a really big way in the Trump era. I talked to David Barker, a professor of government at American University. He says it's no longer entirely clear what exactly it means to be a conservative anymore.
People tend to associate the term with just being like really pro-Trump, but there are a lot of elements to the MAGA right that are largely or wholly inconsistent with what we used to think of as conservatism in the Reagan and Bush eras.
And in the second Trump term, these differences are even more stark. Republicans used to be all about free markets and free trade. Trump has imposed sweeping tariffs. In business, he picks winners and losers and has even pushed for the government to take a portion of certain companies. When it comes to foreign policy, Trump has had little use for long-standing alliances. But America First hasn't meant pure isolationism. Look at the strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities or the buildup of U.S. military might near Venezuela happening now.
And all of this, of course, makes me think about Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who, of course, used to be one of Trump's closest allies. But she announced last week that she is going to step down in January. And that decision, all of this, it's about her disagreements with President Trump. How does she fit into all of this?
Well, it would be hard to find someone more MAGA than Congresswoman Greene. But in the past few months, she had begun to openly question whether Trump was living up to his campaign promises. So he turned on her, called her a traitor, promised to primary her, and she quit. Greene is an iconoclast. She says she never really fit in Congress, but she's casting herself as a representative of common Americans, the very people who Trump's version of the Republican Party appealed to, the working class voters who gave him a winning coalition.
Yeah, and you know, Greene started to talk a lot about these issues that were important to the base: affordability, no foreign intervention, and of course the Epstein files. She defended those as being core to MAGA. So this presents an interesting question, I think, about the movement itself. Is it about that core set of values, or is it about the man himself?
I mean, it makes sense that Trump's shifting vision is upending his Republican Party, but Democrats also seem to be struggling to define themselves right now. What are each of you seeing?
As Trump has remade the Republican Party in his image, you know, so have Democrats sort of centered their party on being anti-Trump. And a byproduct of that is that the party has less identity outside of just opposing Trump. For a lot of moderate and independent voters, and to be honest, some Democratic voters I talked to as well, just being anti-Trump isn't enough.
Trump is the main character in everyone's political lives right now. And that puts Democrats in a position of always responding to him.
The next political test, of course, is next fall in the midterm elections. How are Republicans and Democrats thinking about who their parties are going forward?
Well, the party is shaped by who runs and who wins, right? So I talked to the folks running recruitment efforts in the House on both sides of the aisle. Georgia Congressman Brian Jack is leading recruitment for Republicans. And I asked him, what does the party stand for?
Ultimately, I think for many people, the Republican Party today has been completely overhauled by President Trump in a positive way, because it's a party of blue-collar, working-class folks who want to see our country put first.
And this gets at another way that Trump has transformed the parties. I mean, Democrats have lost their lock on white working-class voters.
It is remarkable just how significantly the party's electorates have changed in the past few decades. Bill Clinton in the 1990s was elected by a coalition that included a whole lot of working-class white voters. Republicans were the party of the elites. And then Trump came along, and now it's almost completely reversed. Steve Tellis is a political scientist at Johns Hopkins University.
There's this tension between all the things people had previously committed to and the fact that now, like, all these things are shaken up in terms of who's in what coalition.
And he says there's a really big question of whether those voters will stay with Republicans once Trump is gone.
Okay, so that was Republicans. Barbara, you mentioned that you talked to both parties about this. How did Democrats respond?
Well, I asked Colorado Congressman Jason Crow, who's leading recruitment for the Democratic side, what does he think the party stands for?
I'm not looking for government to solve my problems. I'm not looking for a handout. What I want is a level playing field. Working class Americans, they all know it's rigged, right? So I'm a Democrat because this is the party that consistently tries to unrig that system.
Now, Juana, if you didn't know that that was a Democrat, what would those first few lines make you think of? You know, like working class, not looking for a government handout. I'm betting that, you know, you might say Republican.
I might. I mean, hearing Congressman Crow say that, it's a little surprising given the large and very vocal left wing of his party.
Yeah, and he's certainly a centrist Democrat. But the language around unrigging the system is also very much in line with the far left of the party, too. Unlike the Republican Party navigating what conservatism means and what MAGA means from a policy level, the challenge for Democrats is different. It's about how to rebuild key parts of their party, like the working class that we talked about.
And how they rebuild trust with voters. There are a lot of people who feel like the system just isn't working for them. And electoral success for Democrats and Republicans alike may well come down to who most persuasively can say, we hear you, and here's a solution.
That's senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith and congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Juana.
And for a deeper dive on all of this, take a listen to today's NPR Politics podcast.
People who drop out of high school often have a hard time going back to earn their diploma or get a GED. Colorado has passed a couple of laws to help them out and to get them on track for a college credential. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundin reports.
About 87% of Americans graduate high school. For the other 13%, dropping out can seem like the only option.
I didn't have a good mother, so I grew up like really fast. I had to raise her, etc., and I didn't get a chance to go to high school.
This is Delana Wilson.
And there was just a lot of trauma going on then. So.
She moved around and tried to get her GED or pass the HiSET exam, both tests equivalent to a high school diploma.
They always told me I'm 1-2 points away.
Each GED exam cost money, and with each failure, her self-esteem chipped away.
So I just always felt like, okay, these people are trying to tell me I'm stupid.
A lot of people need more tutoring support to pass a GED exam. By 2031, Colorado will be one of the four states, plus D.C., where it's hardest for people to find jobs without more than a high school diploma, according to a Georgetown University projection. So the state is trying something new, letting community colleges offer high school diplomas.
The status quo, the system as it is, it's not working. It's leaving too many people behind in a state of discouragement, and they're actively seeking alternatives.
Josh Margolin is with the Community College of Denver. It helps students earn diplomas and learn the rigor to pursue college certificates and degrees in high-demand fields. Delana Wilson had tried other programs 7 times when she heard about CCD. She was 34.
What am I doing here? But then I go, well, like my 15-year-old told me, you're never too old to go back to school, Mom. You know, and I'm going to make it the best $50 I put down, I tell you.
So what's distinct about this program? $50. Pay that, and then you can take an exam and get credit for what you already know. It's self-paced. Students can finish in as little as 5 weeks, but the $50 covers a full year, and in-person classes run evenings and weekends for working adults.
Look, what's squared, cubed, you do 4 times 4.
Justin Avila, a packer at a brewery, wants to move up. Teachers like Amber Gardner check on more than his math progress.
Learning requires us to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, I just sometimes am so frustrated and that the answer is not coming out the way it should.
It gets hard.
Yeah.
And you keep going.
I remember why I didn't pass this in high school.
She reminds him why he's doing this. He now wants to take college classes, like in welding.
You must be proud of yourself.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting somewhere that I really need to be.
So far, 1 in 5 graduates has decided to move on to college classes. To break even, it will take 1 in 4. For now, the college and donors cover the cost. Colorado spends far less than other states on adult education, and advocates want more state funding to expand. The demand for it is clear, 1,000-person waiting list. On her 8th try, Delana Wilson graduated.
I couldn't believe it.
She spent 14 years caring for elderly people, a job she loves. Now she's enrolled in classes to become a behavioral health specialist.
It gave me more than just confidence. It gave me a sense of self. It allowed me to know, now you can believe in yourself. Don't worry about all that. Don't worry about what they said to you as a child growing up. Don't worry about that, because look what you just did.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 25th, 1994, I'm skating on Crooked Lake. And the ice is clear, free of snow, about 3 inches thick, and smooth as a sheet of glass. I couldn't ask for better skating conditions. And while I'm zipping along on the ice, I'm abruptly halted by the sight of a giant water beetle. You all know this guy. Sometimes called the toe biter, sometimes called the electric light bug. It's a 3-inch-long beetle that is unmistakable for anybody who's maybe attended a late-night football game in the fall and had one drop into their lap, or maybe been swimming about in a lake in the summertime and have come across this giant insect. This one is truly noteworthy and noticeable, but this one was crawling along on the underside of the ice, trailing a little bubble attached to the back of its abdomen, which I suspect was an oxygen bubble that it would use if need be, probably going from air bubble to air bubble underneath the ice and finding its way around. It will spend the winter in the ice and probably emerge in the springtime, ready to bite your toe, perhaps.
For NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For more than a century, the U.S. military has supported the Boy Scouts of America, now known as Scouting America. The military has provided medical and logistical help at jamborees and hosted scout units on bases all around the world. That long-standing partnership could be approaching its end. NPR has learned that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth plans to sever all Department of Defense support for scouting. Our Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and Graham Smith of NPR's Investigations Unit have this report.
Every few years, the National Jamboree brings 15,000 to 20,000 scouts to a remote site in West Virginia. President Trump, the scouts' honorary leader, praised the crowd in 2017.
The United States has no better citizens than its Boy Scouts. No better.
And Congress requires by law that the Pentagon support the Jamboree. It lends trucks, ambulances, and medical teams, and puts on aviation and skydiving demonstrations, all at no cost to the scouts. For the military, it's both a training exercise and an opportunity to recruit highly motivated, civic-minded kids.
But the law includes an exemption. The Secretary of Defense can withhold support if he determines providing it would be detrimental to national security. Drafts of a report to Congress show Secretary Pete Hegseth looking to invoke that clause, accusing Scouting America of attacking boy-friendly spaces and fostering gender confusion. NPR obtained the report and other documents from a source with DOD who requested anonymity.
Hegseth's memo to the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, which has not yet been delivered, argues the scouts have strayed from their mission to, quote, cultivate masculine values. It also claims that sending troops, doctors, and vehicles to a 10-day youth event would harm national security by diverting resources from border operations and protecting U.S. territory.
Last year, as a Fox News host, Hegseth complained about the scouts changing their name and admitting girls.
Well, the Boy Scouts has been cratering itself for quite some time. You see, this is an institution the left didn't control. They didn't want to improve it. They wanted to destroy it or dilute it into something that stood for nothing.
His plan goes far beyond cutting off the Jamboree. We also reviewed a draft memo to the secretaries of the military branches, ordering them to end all support to Scouting America, saying the group is no longer a meritocracy. That would mean banning scout troop meetings on military bases in the U.S. and overseas.
That worries Kenny Green. He's a retired Army staff sergeant who served as a sniper in Iraq, and he's the parent of three scouts, two girls and a boy. His family had to move around a lot.
Oh, yeah. We went from Louisiana to Alaska, from Alaska to Germany, from Germany to Texas.
But everywhere they landed, there was a scout troop.
We don't have to say a word to them. Let them go see the other kids, and they'll be immediately integrated in.
We told Green about the Pentagon plan to cut ties.
Yeah, I don't even know how to respond to that. It's going to be kind of harsh the way I say this, I think. It's kind of like they don't care about us more than they care about their perceived message. Scouting probably is not a perfect organization, but its benefits, I can't even say how vast their benefits are, especially for military families.
And that change could hurt recruiting, too. According to a memo Navy Secretary John Phelan sent to Pentagon leaders about this proposal. And here's something else. Some 20% of students at the service academies are Eagle Scouts, and enlistees who've earned that honor get advanced military rank. That practice would end.
Many lawmakers on Capitol Hill were scouts, too. We shared some of our reporting with Representative G.T. Thompson, Republican of Pennsylvania, Eagle Scout, and longtime troop leader. He sent this statement. I can think of no better recruitment tool for our military than the lessons learned in scouting. He says it would be nearsighted to uproot the decades-long partnership.
The Pentagon declined to address our questions about the plan, saying they wouldn't comment on leaked documents that may not be finalized. Scouting America responded to our reporting earlier today by sending a letter out to all scouting families, saying they're proud of the long relationship with the military and urging supporters to contact their members of Congress.
Among the documents NPR reviewed is a draft letter to the head of Scouting America, informing him about the secretary's decision to disapprove the use of DOD personnel and equipment for the Jamboree, detailing what will not be available. It concludes, "You have our best wishes for a safe and successful National Scout Jamboree." Graham Smith.
And Tom Bowman, NPR News.
Hard winter has already arrived in the high country of New York's Adirondack Mountains. It's a joyful time of year for NPR's Brian Mann, who went trekking above the tree line into a world remade by snow and ice and wind.
There is just a beautiful layer of snow on the ground deep in the woods, and it is still and cold. I'm starting early, climbing a mountain called Wright Peak. That means moving through near darkness in the hour before sunrise. There's just enough light in the woods. I can see, but there's no color. It's just like I'm walking through this black and white world of snow and charcoal lines of the hemlock trees, the boughs already really heavy with snow. It's bitter cold, but early enough in the season that I still find open streams. I hop over icy rocks. I've come to a big frozen waterfall, shelf after shelf of ice, and there's water flowing. You can see it kind of bubbling and moving behind the ice. I've climbed high enough that the ice is getting thicker on the trail, and it's also just getting a lot steeper. Pulling on the microspike traction. I just have little metal teeth that dig into the ice. With my cleats digging in, I climb on. In places, I'm on all fours, using trees and rocks for handholds. The air shimmers with particles of ice, but whenever there's a view, I sit to rest and catch my breath. Through the ice fog, I can see big shelves of rock, like the size of buildings, and kind of layered in snow and ice. People ask me sometimes whether it makes sense to still be doing this when I'm in my 60s. The truth is, it's one of my deepest joys, and one of the beauties of mountains is that you just slow down and you move at your own pace and you find the altitude you want to be at. The payoff is solitude and stillness and glimpses of wild beauty. I pick my way above the tree line onto the dome of rock, and by chance, I've timed it perfectly. The wind is fierce, but the ice fog is lifting. At the top, I can only linger a few minutes in that glacial, wild world. Then I turn and start the long descent through the winter forest. Brian Mann, NPR News, on Wright Peak in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. There is a winter storm warning or advisory in effect now until noon for much of northern Minnesota, anywhere from 2 to 8 inches of snow possible, with winds gusting up to 35 miles per hour. Slippery road conditions are expected. Lows tonight 18 to 22, and tomorrow chance of snow before noon, cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 20s. Looking ahead to Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs near 24, blustery northwest winds continue. It is time now for National Native News on KAXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of New Mexico's congressional delegation and Pueblo leaders held a press conference in Albuquerque last week to urge Department of Interior Secretary Doug Burgum to visit Chaco Culture National Historical Park in the state and to continue protections from oil and gas drilling. KUNM's Jeanette Didios has more.
In October, the Bureau of Land Management began a process to revoke protections for 10 miles around Chaco Canyon to allow for possible oil and gas exploration. This comes after the New Mexico Congressional Delegation and Pueblo governors held a press conference in front of the U.S. Capitol in September to demand that the Trump administration protect Chaco. Governor of the Picaris Pueblo, Craig Quinchello, spoke on the cultural significance of Chaco.
Our ancestors lived there, prayed there, studied the stars there, and carried teachings outward into our modern Pueblo communities. Our ties to Chaco live in our songs, our ceremonies, our pilgrimages, and our ancient roads and shrines that stretch far beyond the park itself.
U.S. Senators Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan were in attendance alongside Representative Melanie Stansberry. Stansberry said during the federal shutdown, tribal leaders were unable to reach the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but did receive a letter from the Trump administration informing them that they had 2 weeks to respond to Chaco being taken out of the federal protection.
Can you imagine the cruelty, the insensitivity, the stupidity of an administration contacting tribal leaders as they are trying to figure out how they are going to feed their people and balance their budgets and keep their public safety in order, to tell them that they are going to take away their most sacred lands and open it up for private oil and gas drilling.
Congressional and Pueblo leaders invited Burgum to visit Chaco and to have a meaningful talk with them. I'm Jeanette Didios.
A Kodiak, Alaska-based nonprofit dedicated to supporting families with newborns is expanding into the Northwest Arctic Borough. KMXT's Davis Hovey has more on how Kodiak Kindness is helping families across the state raise babies.
For years, Noya Kwanda Baltazar has been teaching infants in Kotzebue through a local program that serves children with disabilities or delayed development. It's the only such program based out of a school district in the state. Baltazar says it's about helping kids from birth to 3 years old and their families around the Manilik service area, which covers 12 communities in northwest Alaska from Kotzebue to Kobuk.
Working with birth to three, it's always good about helping families, ensuring that they're strong, supported, and any way we can support families and nursing moms to help their babies grow, I think is great.
Baltazar and Francis Williams from Ambler are bringing their experience working with children to Kodiak Kindness as they continue doing what they already do, but under the new title of peer counselors.
I'll be able to do my own mix, you know, with Kodiak Kindness and my Inupiaq traditions.
Williams says she uses native plants like stinkweed or spruce trees to make salves or other traditional medicines to help her friends, family, and neighbors heal from the land. Aside from the traditional knowledge Williams has from her mom and aunties, she'll also be able to help her community with assistance from a certified lactation consultant if she wants support virtually from the Kodiak Kindness team via telehealth. Kodiak Kindness's two new peer counselors in the Northwest Arctic Borough come online this winter and hope to start enrolling families in the region early next year. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Now more than ever, the supporters of this and all Native Voice One programs deserve a little extra love. Learn more about all our public radio underwriters and web-based sponsors at koahnic.org/sponsors-spotlight.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Pentagon says it will investigate Arizona Senator Mark Kelly for, quote, serious allegations of misconduct after he participated in a video addressing military troops.
Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders.
Senator Kelly, who's a retired Navy fighter pilot and NASA astronaut, reminded troops that they swore an oath to the Constitution. He appeared in the video along with five other Democratic lawmakers who had also served in the military or in the intelligence community. Well, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called the video, quote, despicable, reckless, and false, and has threatened to have Senator Kelly court-martialed. Meanwhile, President Trump has called the video, quote, seditious behavior, punishable by death, and even suggested that the participating lawmakers be hanged. As we await details on the investigation, we wanted to look into what the lawmakers suggested in that video to, quote, refuse illegal orders. How would that actually work? Well, to help us answer that question, we're joined now by Rachel Van Landingham, a former military lawyer and current law professor at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Elsa.
So I've often heard members of the military say to me, they call them orders, not requests, for a reason. But let me ask you, if an order is illegal, can an active duty member refuse to follow that order?
Yes, if an active duty member knows that an order is unlawful, they must disobey it. Or if they should know it's unlawful, that is, in order to commit a crime, go shoot those peaceful protesters in Chicago. That is manifestly unlawful. And not only does a military member, should they disobey it, they must disobey it. But they do so, Elsa, at their peril.
Okay, let's explain why it is at their peril. Explain how it would work if a member recognizes that an order is unlawful and decides they will not follow it.
Well, then, because the military's lifeblood as a hierarchical organization has run on obedience to orders for centuries, there is a presumption that all orders, if issued by a competent authority and that relate to a military duty, that all orders are presumptively lawful. So if a military member disobeys an order, even if it's unlawful, they potentially could be court-martialed for disobedience. They will be vindicated at court by a military trial judge who has the responsibility to decide the legality of the order. But there is a military crime, and actually several related crimes, regarding disobedience of orders. But again, that's disobedience of lawful orders. But the military member then has to show at court that the order they disobeyed was unlawful.
In your experience as a military lawyer, how would you characterize the success rate of a member of a military in a court-martial challenging an order that was deemed unlawful by them?
Well, it normally doesn't get that far. And one of the most recent cases we've had was a major in the United States Army who didn't want to obey the order to wear the United Nations insignia during the 1990s in a deployment to the Kosovo region. And he challenged that. He worked with the military lawyers who said this is a lawful order. His commanders worked with him. And he was eventually court-martialed because he refused to wear the UN beret and the UN insignia. And it went up to our highest military appellate court. And they said, this was a matter of policy. This was not an unlawful order. And his conviction was upheld. So there's not a great success rate. However, there is a duty to disobey in order to commit a crime, such as kill that detainee in your custody, right? And if the military member follows that unlawful order, they're criminally liable for murder at that point.
Wow. Okay, well, this investigation into Kelly specifically, It is the latest move by the Trump administration to seek retribution against President Trump's perceived political enemies. But this time it's the Pentagon, not the Justice Department, leading the investigation. Why do you think the administration is using the Pentagon instead of DOJ to go after Kelly here?
It's part of intimidation and threatening. And because Senator Kelly, you know, who is a war hero, a NASA astronaut, and a powerful senator, I think that he is the only one that they could do this against because they're, unfortunately, I think it's unconstitutional, but there is unfortunately UCMJ, military criminal law jurisdiction over Senator Kelly because he's a retiree. Even reservists, when they're not on active duty, don't fall under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but he does as a retiree. And there are numerous crimes, military unique crimes, that have a greater expanse over freedom of expression. That is, the First Amendment doesn't apply as broadly to those in the military. So I think they're using or threatening to use, because this is not going to go anywhere. We have the speech and debate clause, which provides for immunity from civil and criminal prosecution for activities that legislators do as lawmakers. And it provides protection for more than just their activities while they're speaking on the Senate or congressional floor. It has to do with their duties related to being a lawmaker, and Senator Kelly made this video in his duties as a lawmaker. So I think there's a constitutional shield against any kind of criminal prosecution. And the founding fathers drafted that clause in order to protect sitting lawmakers from intimidation and harassment by the executive branch through the use of harassing criminal prosecutions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, putting aside potential legal defenses that Senator Kelly might have, the threat is to have him court-martialed. Let me just ask you, can a retired officer face court-martial for actions after he retires from the military? Has this ever happened before?
Yes, it has. And the most recent case in which the constitutionality of that far-reaching jurisdiction was challenged, and it was upheld at the circuit court level. We had a retiree from the Marine Corps that sexually assaulted an American citizen in Japan. The Japanese didn't want to prosecute, and U.S. federal criminal law did not apply extraterritorially to that sexual assault. So the only thing that applied was the Uniform Code of Military Justice's offense of the criminal offense of sexual assault. So the military recalled that retired service member for prosecution. But you can see it's been used as a jurisdictional gap filler, not as a way to intimidate and chill and threaten sitting members of Congress.
Okay. Well, assuming that Kelly can be court-martialed, even though he has retired from the military, based on what Kelly said in this video that we're talking about, is there anything in your legal opinion that could justify a court-martial?
Absolutely not. Senator Kelly restated accurately the actual law. Military members should and must disobey all orders that they either know are unlawful or should know are unlawful. In order to commit a crime, they should be disobeying, or an order that they otherwise know is unlawful, they should be disobeying. And so reminding service members of their legal duties is an under no stretch of anyone's imagination an actual crime.
Rachel Van Landingham of Southwestern Law School, thank you very much for clearing all of this up.
Thank you, Elsa.
And just a note, we are speaking directly to Senator Mark Kelly elsewhere on this show.
When I was the commander of the space shuttle, especially, I used to tell my shuttle crew members that they were required to question my decisions. It was not optional. And if you think we should be doing something differently, and especially if it affects safety and mission success, you have to tell me about it, and we're going to figure it out together. I don't think Donald Trump has that, you know, an ounce of that instinct in his bones.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:44. Coming up in just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. We also thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information at northhomes.org. There's a winter storm warning or advisory in effect for much of northern Minnesota. Tonight, an additional 3 to 7 inches possible in northeastern and north central Minnesota, 1 to 2 inches in northwestern Minnesota, including Bemidji. Blustery north northwest winds up to 40 miles per hour. Lows tonight 18 to 22.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
why Minnesota may have to stop selling THC edibles and drinks. Then, a new state requirement to benefit employees is creating questions and confusion for business owners. And a funding opportunity for the state's urban farmers. I'm Gracie J. A provision tucked into the federal government funding bill could effectively shut down Minnesota's booming THC edibles and beverages market. THC is the main psychoactive compound in cannabis, and it interacts with the body to produce various effects. The measure caps hemp-derived products at 0.4 milligrams of THC per container, far below the serving found in Minnesota's drinks and edibles. Minnesota currently has 5,000 licensed retailers and generates more than $200 million in annual revenue from hemp-derived THC products. It is still unclear how the provision will affect the industry. In today's main story, as Minnesota gets ready to roll out its paid family and medical leave program, small businesses are working to understand what the new law will mean for them and what they need to do. Faya Adam reports.
Minnesota's new paid leave law is a statewide insurance fund that will offer employees guaranteed time off and job protection for medical leave. It will start January 1st, but for some business owners, there is still a lot of confusion.
Right now, I don't really know that much about it.
Matt Caron is a co-founding partner at Caron Chiropractic in St. Paul, which has 18 employees.
As I'm aware, we need to let our employees know more about it and then kind of learn more about exactly what it is and what it entails. Sounds like if someone has a need for the family leave, there are certain criteria that the state will decide if that's, you know, okay or not.
The program as itself, foundationally, it allows 12 weeks of paid medical leave. You can also qualify for bonding time. If you qualify for both of those within one 12-month period, you can only get up to a total of 20 weeks off.
That's State Representative Cedric Frazier explaining how the program works.
For some of our independent contractors, they can opt in. So if you're not employed within a particular organization, you can opt in and have access to the state program, which can be a good benefit. This is really going to be important for small businesses that can't afford to run this type of program or provide this kind of benefit themselves.
Right now, Matt Caron's clinic doesn't have a formal plan in place if an employee needs to go on leave. But he says they've handled it before on an informal basis.
We've had different people take time off for maternity and other things, and it seems like, you know, it works out okay.
The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development website says businesses with 30 or fewer people and lower average wages qualify for a reduced premium rate. There are grants to help businesses pay for extra staff, higher wages, or training while employees on paid leave. Representative Fraser says the goal is to make it easier on employers.
The main thing that should be noted is that for a majority of employers, the program is going to be run through the state, so they can actually refer the employees directly to the department to access the program.
That's something Dr. Matt is happy to hear.
Kind of thought, well, that might be kind of good having something like that, and that seemed like it wasn't going to be a big cost.
Many businesses are now waiting for the program to roll out to find out more about how it works.
On the face of it, it sounds like a good idea. And we'll just see how it rolls out. We've talked about it like in one little staff meeting, and I don't think they understand much about it. It'll be interesting to see if they like it or not.
Employers must give workers a written notice about the new paid leave by December 1st, and the program itself begins January 1st. Find more information, visit pl.mn.gov. For North Star Stories, I'm Phi Adam.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Urban farmers can now apply for grants to support conservation-focused improvements on their farms. To be eligible, farms must be commercially operated in Minnesota and located in or selling into a city with more than 5,000 residents, or be located on federally recognized tribal land and serving tribal community members. Grant funds can cover tools, supplies, services, and other expenses tied to conservation improvements. Applications are available in English, Spanish, Hmong, and Somali, and can be found on the Urban Farm Conservation Grant webpage.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. All right, think for a second about a lion's roar. You've heard this sound, I'm sure. Or some version of that sound. This particular roar comes courtesy of a lion named Geronimo. Well, what if I told you that this sound was also a roar? It is actually a new type of roar altogether, one discovered by researchers at the University of Exeter with the help of AI. They say their findings, which were published this month in the journal Ecology and Evolution, could help in lion conservation efforts. Lead author Jonathan Grocott joins me now to talk about roars. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with this. Tell me about this new roar, what it sounds like, why it's different.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I think everybody potentially knows of a lion's roar. They've heard it through so much different media. But what you may not know is that lions roar in what's recorded as a roaring bout. So they actually start off with a series of soft moans that develop into these roars. And then the vocalization subsides with a series of grunts. The specific part of this roar, which is called a full-throated roar, has recently been shown to be an individually unique signature for lions. A bit like human fingerprints. So you can identify lions by this specific type of roar.
Everybody has a different roar. We heard Geronimo's, others are slightly different.
Exactly. But it's specifically this full-throated roar. And previously, selecting this roar out of all of the other vocalizations within the roaring bout has been challenging because of this, as we've discovered, this second intermediary roar.
What makes a roar a roar? Like, why does this matter? And what's the difference between a roar, like roar, and another noise that a lion would make?
So the full-throated roar is the loudest, most complex part of the lion's roaring bout. It starts as a low pitch, it rises to a high pitch, and then drops down again to a low pitch. Almost like if you imagine someone really yawning, really stretching and yawning. The intermediary roar, on the other hand, is a flatter vocalization. There is less variation in pitch. Mm-hmm. From a monitoring perspective, we could use these full-throated roars potentially as a conservation tool. If we can tell which lion is Geronimo and which lion is potentially Perseus or Steve or Sandra, then we can start to count the number of individuals in a landscape. And if we can count these individuals, we can derive population estimates, which is a really crucial conservation metric. You can then turn understanding of population trends into conservation hotspots where you can target certain places with on-the-ground conservation activities.
So we said earlier that AI was able to identify this new type of roar that I guess human researchers hadn't fully realized was a roar before. How exactly did that work? What was AI picking up on that trained expert ears had not picked up on?
So as we heard before, the difference between these two roars is quite marginal. And even for expert ears, it was really challenging to understand these differences and to even notice that there were differences. I can detect them, but I've listened to thousands and thousands of roars. And so what we wanted the AI model to be able to do was pick out these specific metrics within these roars, so maximum frequency and duration, which are really challenging for humans to hear, but the AI can use that to predict which types of roars are which. And what we found was that the full-throated roars the AI model predicted, this bespoke AI model that we built, actually did a better job at then differentiating between the different individuals down the line.
You spent a lot of time
thinking about and studying lions. What's your favorite aspect of lions?
Oh, I mean, you've got to respect how much they sleep. Any animal that spends 20 hours a day doing basically nothing has got to be respected there, I think. I still remember the very first time I saw a lion, which was on a night drive, and there was this sole lioness that was just skulking through the undergrowth, and I was just captivated. So I think there's just something so brilliant about an animal that is so secretive by nature, but is also just so iconic.
Mm-hmm. That is Jonathan Grocott, PhD student and researcher at the University of Exeter. Thank you for talking lion roars with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
The oldest survivor of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre died yesterday. Viola Ford Fletcher was 111 years old. Elizabeth Caldwell from member station KWGS has this remembrance.
Viola Ford Fletcher was just 7 years old when she fled the prosperous Tulsa neighborhood known as Black Wall Street. She said her family lost everything after an enraged white mob destroyed about 35 city blocks and, according to historians, killed as many as 300 people. In 2023, she testified before a House committee.
When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the fourth grade.
Fletcher worked as domestic help to white families near Tulsa for most of her life. She raised three children. Fletcher accused the perpetrators of the massacre, who included government officials, of living in wealth while she struggled in poverty.
I have been blessed with a long life and have seen the best and the worst of this country. I think about the horror inflicted upon black people in this country every day.
But she credited love, not bitterness, as the secret to a long life during an interview last year on her 110th birthday.
Being fair and with others and with the lifestyle and everything, I've always, you know, been on the honest side and cooperate.
Fletcher did get some private donations throughout the years, but her legal bid for compensation for the massacre from the state of Oklahoma and the city of Tulsa stalled. In an interview last year, her attorney, DeMario Solomon Simmons, said she remained warm-hearted despite the setback.
She has just this great attitude, this wonderful, loving spirit.
Remembrances for the super centenarian have been pouring out on social media. Tulsa's first black mayor, Monroe Nichols, announced the news of her death to the city, calling Fletcher's life a reminder of how far we have come and how far we must still go. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Caldwell in Tulsa.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, in select theaters Wednesday, everywhere December 5th. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at MacFound.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. We're currently under a winter storm warning or advisory, with snow likely tonight, 3 to 7 inches in northeastern and north central Minnesota, 1 to 2 in northwest.